And now I'd like to bring to the podium Mr. Larry Hartig, DEC Commissioner, who is here to introduce our speaker today. Larry.
Well, thank you, Lisa, and good afternoon, everyone. That's not my usual job to greet foreign dignitaries, but I always enjoy it. I appreciate Patricia Eckert and others from the governor's office that allow me to do this. I am DEC Commissioner Larry Hartig, and before I introduce our speakers today, I'd just like to note the Honorary Consul of Germany, Michael Jensen, is also here with us today, and I want to welcome him here. And Ambassador, it's good seeing you again. I hope you're enjoying your visit to Alaska. We had lunch the other day together. Now it's my honor to introduce our two speakers today. Maciej Pisarski, the Deputy Chief of Mission for the Embassy of Poland in Washington, D.C. And previous to this post, he served in several capacities over the years for the Polish Ministry of Foreign Affairs, including as the head and deputy director of the Department of Strategy and Foreign Policy Planning and the deputy director of the Department of Americas. He wrote his master's thesis at the University of Warsaw Department of History on the perspectives of Jewish emigration from Poland, 1945 through 51, co-authored studies on history and culture of Jews in Poland after 1945, and published the yearbook of the Polish foreign policy and Polish-American relations. Joining him is Dr. Philip Ackermann, who began his post as Minister and Deputy Chief of Mission at the Embassy of the Federal Republic of Germany in Washington, D.C. in March 2014. Dr. Ackermann received his, and I don't know if I'll say this right, Magister Artium, something like that, sorry, and his doctorate in art history from Bonn University in Germany. Since joining the German Foreign Service in 1993, Dr. Ackermann has served as an exchange diplomat at the Dutch Ministry of Foreign Affairs at The Hague, second secretary at the German Embassy in Rabat, Morocco, first secretary of the Permanent Representation of Germany to the UN in New York, the civilian head of the German Provincial Reconstruction Team in Kunduz, I probably butchered that one too, Afghanistan, and Minister Consular of the German Embassy in New Delhi. We are honored to welcome the Deputy Chiefs of Mission, who are here today to speak to us on the EU's role as an international actor, TTIP and beyond. So please join me in welcoming them to the podium.
Before we start, let me just say, first of all, how thrilled we are to be with you today. It's just fantastic to be in Alaska, and I had the most amazing experience in this state, and we are very, very happy to be here, and we are very thankful to the World Affairs Council to have invited us to Alaska. We will speak about 15, 20 minutes, and then we want to do that interactively. I think this is much better than we want to respond to questions, and we want to engage in a discussion with you. So don't expect long lectures. Please prepare while listening to us for things you want to know, things you want to throw at us, if you want to scold us, if you want to...
Toughest questions.
Yeah, toughest questions, but also nice questions. that's just to say thank you again, and I think Maciej will now start, and then we'll...
Yes, and I just want to say how lucky and happy we are to be here, and thank you very much for a very nice introduction, Mr. Commissioner. Thank you very much for the invitation. Thanks to give us an opportunity to cool off a little bit from Washington in heat. We're very grateful for the opportunity. We're supposed to talk about why the European Union is important to Alaskans, but let me offer a little bit kind of a broader perspective and put this question in a kind of broader perspective, because you know, it's been very often that the European Union has come under criticism, I would say that most of the time undeserved criticism, and we tend to forget or take for granted those very important achievements and great things happened, that were brought about because of the European integration. And then, just to support this, I'd like to, tell you a little story. I mean, 76 years ago, the Second World War started when Nazi Germany invaded Poland. 70 years ago, Poland and Germany were, you know, devastated, lay in ruin. Both countries were very bitter enemies. Yet 25 years ago, the Iron Curtain went down, and then miraculous changes happened in Europe, and then Polish-German reconciliation that happened 25 years ago was one of those miracles that was brought about by the European integration. The German-French reconciliation decades before opened up the process of European integration. I mean, it turned countries who had history of fighting with each other to cooperate with, you know, with each other for a mutual and common good. The Polish-German reconciliation was very instrumental in not only for Poland and Germany to get on a very friendly and footing as neighbors, but also it was what was helpful for German unification. It was also very instrumental in bridging the divide of Europe that occurred after the Second World War by bringing Poland and other Central Eastern European countries into the Union, and thus solidifying the democratic change took place in our part of the continent. So I would argue that the EU has been one of the most, if not the most successful reconstruction project, the project that is based on values and the project in which the reconciliation has always been a very important part of it. And I think it can still serve as an inspiration, as a model, also currently in these days. I mean, because here, I mean, in the world, we have so many divisions, so many challenges. Thank you.
I just to add on that, the fact that I sit here next to Maciej, my friend from Poland, when I grew up, that was unthinkable. You know, we never would have dreamt of the fact that we sit together here and, you know, give you a lecture, a common lecture on what the EU is. And this should not be taken for granted. It's a development that is very, very strong and deep in our hearts, so to speak. So that the EU has a very moral and psychological impact on Europe also. So when you, I think we were supposed to talk about the fact whether the EU is an international actor or an actor on the international field. And I would say, reading the American newspapers and listening to the American media, you would say that there is a sort of a skepticism, to say the least, when it comes to the role of the EU. Let me just say one thing which I think Americans sometimes don't understand correctly. The EU is a body that is unique in very many respects. And the uniqueness about the EU is that nation states, in this case 28 nation states, surrendered part of their power to a supranational body. A thing I would say that the US would never be ready to do. You know, the fact that you say some aspects of our political cooperation or our political and economic, in this case, very important, economic activities are dedicated to a supranational body in Brussels is a step that you have to take, and this requires some boldness. You know, if Europe is full of small nations, Germany and Poland are bigger ones, but there are also, you know, nations like Slovenia or Ireland that have less inhabitants, very strong tradition, very strong history. And they are. Everybody ends up saying that in the globalized world where we are today, it's better to have a supranational body that defends your interests on the international stage. That is a huge progress, we would say, from our point of view. At the same time, it also says clearly that this supranational body is not a very light-footed, elegant and quick institution. It is a very, very tedious procedure. The EU is so complicated that even an EU citizen doesn't understand how it works correctly. You have to accept that. It's very, very complicated. But this complication is the consequence of this insight that you have to dedicate this power on a supranational level. So, for example, and Marcia will talk about TTIP a little later, but when the Commission negotiates the TTIP agreement between the United States and Europe, you have to imagine there is somebody sitting at the table, but 28 little dwarfs are looking over the shoulder whether the Commissioner Malmström, does the right things, because, you know, Slovenia, Italy, and Latvia have different interests when it comes to this. So don't expect the EU to be a very, very bold, courageous international actor. It has to go back to the member states, to the different levels of coordination within the member states. I think we have come a long way. We have made progress. There is a EU foreign minister, Federica Mogherini. She is the high representative of the foreign policy of the EU. But she is, incrementally, I think she's very active on the international stage. One good example is the EU, through Federica Mogherini, through the Office of the European External Action Service, was facilitating the Iran negotiations, the Iran deal we have been talking about so much. Mm-hmm. So you had Iran plus the six nations sitting at a table negotiating, and there was one facilitator that was the EU. So the EU was very present in this. So that shows what a constructive role the EU can take right now. And I think when it comes to the Western Balkans, that's certainly not an area where Alaska has a sound interest in, and I understand that because it's also very complicated and not very. But when we speak about Kosovo, when we speak about Serbia, when we speak about Montenegro and Bosnia, the EU has had a very, very constructive role. So we see areas where the EU has achieved something, and the External Action Service and the EU foreign policy really is making headway. Now, what are the biggest challenges for the EU external in immediate context? I would say, first of all, we have a dramatic and catastrophic situation in the Middle East, and partly also in North Africa, we should not forget. The developments in Syria are really devastating, and this is certainly sort of the most urgent field of trying to find solutions for this foreign policy problem. And frankly speaking, we haven't seen lots of good ideas, not only from the EU, but also from the United States and other international players. The Syria crisis seems to leave us clueless, and so far, I think we will not expect Syria to get resolved in the near future. A second very important issue is this is more relevant for Alaska, is how to deal with Russia. Russia and my country, for example, have developed a relation over the last 25 years that was very, very fruitful, very economically extremely interesting and rewarding, and also politically quite sort of interwoven. And since last year, since the annexation of Crimea, and since the sort of the unacceptable interference in eastern Ukraine, we have gone back to square one. I think the German-Russian relationship is really as bad as it was 20 years ago, and that's, I think, valid for the whole of the European Union. And now the EU has to find ways and means to interact with Russia. It's clear that we can't sort of build a wall between Russia and the EU. It's clear that we have to engage them somehow. It's clear that we have to talk to them. But we have also to be very clear that things like Ukraine are unacceptable. And I think the sanctions we have imposed on Russia, very strict and rigid sanctions, have shown to the Russian side that they have to pay a price for this behavior. Whether they accept this price is another question, but they know that this goes not unheard for them. The third issue, and this is perhaps the most urgent one we have to face right now, is the migration crisis. This weekend alone, Germany expects 40,000 new refugees from Syria. And we have a flow of migration which is unheard of and unseen so far. I think it's the biggest sort of wave of migration since 1945, where all our countries, Poland like Germany, have been the victim of these huge migration movements from east to west, from north to south. And what we see now is a dramatic situation with a humanitarian crisis, with refugees coming in, and where, you know, this is something where EU doesn't become so obvious, because every nation state, of course, has its own ways of dealing with this crisis, its own tradition, its own perception, its own fears also when it comes to the crisis. Now, my country has been extremely generous so far, and has made it clear that we feel this seeking asylum is a very, very important right in our constitution. But it's crystal clear that, you know, we will expect 800,000 Syrian refugees this year. It's 1% of our population. We can't do the same thing next year. It's impossible. I mean, there's a sort of a level, a ceiling where you can't. So I think one of the major challenges the EU faces right now is trying to get to a common approach to this crisis. There are various proposals on the table. People talk about distribution. Some people talk about quotas. Then we have to clearly help the vulnerable parts of the EU that are exposed to the borders, like Greece or Italy to a certain extent, where, you know, people cross the Mediterranean constantly and come in numbers that, you know, can't be coped with by the Greek, for example, authorities. So we have to think about that also. And we have to think how we organize this somehow jointly. Now, late, but at least they did. The EU ministers of interior will meet very soon, and there will be, on the 14th next week, there will be a summit on the head of state and government level in order to overcome this crisis. We haven't come very far in the EU so far, a little disappointing, but not unusual for the EU. But we have to keep trying, and at the end of the day, I am quite confident that we'll find some solution, albeit that some part of the solution might be a bit muddling through, but that's also very European in a way. So I think perhaps this is the biggest challenge the EU faces today, this migration crisis. I think we have to clearly see that if this fails, if the solution to this migration crisis fails, the EU itself will be put in question to a certain extent. I think it's by far the biggest challenges the EU has seen for a long time, much bigger than, for example, the financial crises we have seen with Spain, Greece, Ireland, Portugal over the last years, who have kept us very busy for a long time, perhaps too busy sometimes. Mm-hmm. But you know, most of these crises have been somehow resolved or are on the way of being resolved. The migration crisis puts us in a totally different position. I think I'll stop here. Matthew, you want to talk about TTIP a bit, and then we'll open up.
Yes, thank you very much, Philip. And before I jump into TTIP, I just would like to echo what Philip just said about the immigration crisis, and from the perspective of the country who has not been directly that much affected, I can tell you that there is an understanding for coming together with a workable, effective solution in a spirit of solidarity with the people who have fled the conflict-ridden countries, and then we will discuss the details of that accommodation in the weeks to come. But as we in the Polish-German relations are kind of not forgetting about the past, but looking more into the future, I think that it is also a task for the transatlantic community, that is United States and European Union, kind of to, you know, look into the future a little bit more. The United States and Europe has forged a very strong military alliance for many decades. That alliance has been very effective in keeping our part of the world safe and secure, and spreading stability and peaceful cooperation beyond its border. I mean, of course, NATO. So I think that the future challenge is to think about how we can broaden our joint appeal and joint kind of weight and impact on the global affairs, and of course, economic dimension would be the key to make sure that the world order, which was created after the Second World War, based on liberal and values, democracy, human rights, rule of law, open markets, free trade, would continue to serve not only our countries but also the countries beyond. And I think that this is why this is a worthy transatlantic trade and investment initiative fits very well, because it starts as a it has this component of the freeing trade between Europe and the United States even more through lifting or reducing tariffs and non-tariffs barriers. We hope to achieve greater trade turnout and, of course, investment opportunities by tackling some regulatory challenges, differences in standards and regulations. Huge opportunities lay in opening up the services market and public procurement. This is especially what the European Union is very much interested in. So some say that some researchers who look into this matter say that if the TTIP is implemented as it is meant to, the EU GDP will grow by $160 billion yearly, and the US GDP will grow by approximately $120 billion. And of course, everybody in, each of us will feel the positive positive effect of it. But our partnership will also have a very positive spillover into the global economic trade and development. Some say that that the world would will benefit like 100 billion additional trade when TTIP is implemented. The very important element of TTIP is the setting rules and standards regulations for the future. In the innovative areas, with the new technologies, I mean, we have United States and European Union, we have an live opportunity to come up with joint solutions that would be something like a gold standard. I mean, something that others will look up and then try to also implement. Because when we think about it, I mean, European Union and United States will constitute a huge market power of 800,000 million people. People, who have cherished the similar values and the converging interests, and can have this very positive impact on the future development, not only of the transatlantic area, but way beyond it.
Yeah, I hate to pour a bit water in the wine. I think that sounds everything is fine, and I absolutely echo what Marcia says. But we have to see; it's not that easy. Yeah, we are. This is Europe. Nothing is easy. Everything is complicated. So the negotiation, the TTIP negotiations, are a bit tedious. It's going very slow for reasons, for various reasons. I think that the negotiations are. A bit, they lose themselves into technicalities, and I think at the end of the day we need really political guidance to resolve this. Americans don't understand why it is so complicated. Now I say the 28 nations at a table are complicated, and actually you should learn the word is complicated. This is how it is. And the complication is not something that can be avoided, and except that, or in addition to that, it doesn't get us unemployed. That's also very important. but complications are to be foreseen, and I think at the end of the day, the leadership must decide whether we go on or not. And I have not spoken about resistance within Europe that is also there against TTIP. In Germany, for example, the government is very much pro-TTIP. Germany, a country that lives of exports, basically, so is extremely interested in free trade agreements. The population is a bit more skeptical because they feel that they might be overflooded by not acceptable American goods. When you talk to them and say there's nobody who forces you to buy GMO products, then they think a bit, but they are a bit, there's a sort of a general skepticism towards. But I don't want I think what Marcia says is totally correct, and we totally share the same view. So we would be open to, yep, to answer your questions now. Please go ahead.
Hello. I had the pleasure of attending your presentation last night, and knowing that I would return again today, I did some research late last night. I wanted to understand what the pros and cons are for these issues. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues that I touched upon, I was reading DIW Berlin publication, and it said that the investor state dispute settlement, ISDS, mechanism of TTIP has caused quite a bit of controversy. Mm-hmm. And that's where transnational corporations are granted legal privileges and can sue local governments if they impede their progress. Mm-hmm. But I was wondering if you could touch upon that and explain, please.
I will be happy to do so. It's a very, very technical issue, and I'll try to make it easy. It's complicated, again. the thing is that when investors come to another country, and the conditions change under which they do their investment, there is in free trade agreements, there is a possibility to go to a third side in order to resolve the dispute. Mm-hmm. And normally this third side is an outside law firm. For example, it would be in an old traditional ISDS context, we would say a big Canadian law firm would be ruling over a dispute between the US and Germany, let's say, or US and Poland. And that the people of Germany, this is a very German issue, don't like. And the reason for that, I can tell you very clearly, you know that Germany has, and this is nationwidely, is accepted throughout the nation, is phasing out of nuclear energy. We will stop our nuclear energy for environmental reasons by 2022 or something. So we are shrinking. And there is a huge energy provider from Sweden, Vattenfall, who invested enormously in Germany. And when the rules changed, Vattenfall sued the German government for changing the rules and therefore changing the conditions of their investment at the time. And you know this dispute has a big chance to be won by Vattenfall in a third party. In this case, it's a lawyer somewhere in Europe. I can't or a law firm somewhere in Europe. And I think that the German energy providers, you know, who provide energy, they can't sue the government because they are in Germany. And that people in Germany don't accept that as a notion. So they want to exclude this ISDS problem. Now, what is the proposal on the table, and I think the Commission, the European Commission, has taken it up, to install a tribunal, not going to a big Canadian law firm, but trying to set up a body, like a court, say, for these kind of independent judges who are not paid hundreds of thousands of dollars for that. And this is a thing we feel that might go into the right direction. And I hear that the Americans are a bit surprised by it, but at the end of the day, they say that might be also a way out. We are not there yet, but the ISDS is one of the big problems in the TTIP. So there are a couple of, please.
Thank you for being here. I'm Tam Agosta-Giesel, and I serve on the Anchorage School Board, so obviously I have an education question for both of you from an EU perspective. In our district, just for a little background, we're very, very diverse. People have a hard time understanding that we have the three most diverse high schools in the entire United States, eight of the top middle schools, and 19 of the top 20. In fact, our young people from an elementary school here called Wonder Park give a face to that diversity. We deal with many, when we're accepting many of these refugees and immigrants to this country, we deal not only with the challenge of the linguistic barriers that we have to overcome in getting them proficient in English. But many of the traumas that they bring, we love to put acronyms to it, ACEs, Adverse Childhood Education Syndrome. Mm. How are you dealing with that, particularly Germany, that's already taken in such a huge number of refugees, and Poland, and the whole EU? How are you dealing with those adverse experiences that get in the way of any type of academic performance?
Should I first?
Yes, yes.
It's a very good question. It's a very pertinent question, actually. And we have, what I'm seeing from Germany, this cooling question for these kids. All these refugees are, 78% of the refugees are below 40. So it's a very young crowd coming to Germany, and they bring their very young kids. And this is a big, big problem because we don't have enough teachers also. It's a shortage of teachers who can teach them German. So we recruit a lot of people who can cope with that. And the problem is language is of essence. You need to speak the language in order to integrate properly. So what we set up now is what we call the Willkommensklasse, a welcome class, where these Syrian kids are taught German exclusively. They sit together with one teacher and try to get it in a German mode. And after a certain while, you know, when they have the basics, then they are blended in the classes. It's the best thing we can offer right now. I think in the long-term run, that might be one of the core problems we have to face with.
Well, in case of Poland, we are just developing this, you know, this system of absorbing the immigrants into our society. In the past, most immigrants we had were from Slavic-speaking countries, like, you know, Ukraine, Belarus, and parts of Russia. So the linguistic barrier was not that great, and given the kind of that these were kind of very almost similar but not that distant languages, but obviously with people from Middle East that would be a different story.
I'm Didi Hitchens. I'm the British Honorary Consul for Alaska. Excellent. I'm Professor Emerita of Political Science. When I came to Alaska, I worked for years before that on the European Union, or as it then was, the European Community. And I'm also a past president of the World Affairs Council. I know that in the planning of this meeting, originally it was going to be the German and the British deputy heads of mission who were going to be here. Bearing in mind that Britain is one of the major, in size, members of the European Community Union, and that it is so reluctant and it is so skeptical and that it is not a part of the monetary union, would this presentation have been different had we had that difference? And is that one of the things that adds to the difficulty in terms of the TTIP? Are some of the members who are reluctant, does it make the negotiations less easy?
I have to answer that, Mathieu, because I think we have to defend my friend Patrick here, who can't be here with us today.
I'll be defending him as well.
Yeah. we indeed plan to come together, and I think he would have loved. I sent him photos, and I got very, very sad sighs from Washington, saying that I wish I was with you now. So I think the presentation wouldn't have been very different. Knowing Patrick, who is a very, very pro-European, he's anyway perhaps not sort of representative for the majority of his country. I would say on TTIP, the Brits are totally aligned. You know, there is no difference when it comes to TTIP. Britain is a very free trade-oriented country, and they really like the idea to get sort of these networks. And I think on the TTIP field, I would say Britain is a very constructive and extremely engaged and committed partner. Mm-hmm. And that, having said that, it shows how important for Germany it is to have the UK inside the Union. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the skepticism, and perhaps Mathieu can say a word of that too, you know, Britain hasn't had this history between Poland and Germany, between France and Germany, this sort of emotional and to a certain extent also sentimental attachment we have to the EU is not that present in Britain because their history is different, and I understand that and I respect that also. Having said that, what I don't understand, and I'll be very frank here, in Britain is that they say, "Yeah, well, you know, we have our we have had our colonies, and in fact our our common understanding is much better between India and Pakistan and Canada and UK than between Germany and the UK. And that's flat out wrong, actually. Yeah? That's flat out wrong. I'm not talking about Canada, a great country, we love them. They could be member of the European Union anytime. But I'm talking about, you know, I lived in India and I know that this is sentimental dreaming, if I'm not mistaken. I would say that if Britain leaves the EU, it would be a disaster for the European Union. It would be a catastrophe for Britain.
Yeah. Fully agreed. And then I'd like to say that when Poland and other countries entered the EU 2004, the UK has been one of the most generous countries in terms of inviting kind of newcoming citizens of the newcoming EU members, opening up its market, its borders, and several hundred thousand Poles immigrated to the UK, and they have been very successful. I mean, they have contributed a great deal to the strength of the British economy, and they've been in kind of vast majority a very good good citizens. If not all of them are already British citizens. So I think that there is in the UK there is a constituency that understands the not only the challenges and concerns but also the benefits of the of the European integration and those of the UK being remaining a part of the UK. I could only echo Philip's remarks that for us, I mean, it's very important that the UK stays in, and if it decides to leave, that I mean, we don't want to discuss this black scenario. Yeah, I think a good compromise will be worked out because this is in everybody's interest.
Yeah, this is, sorry.
Yeah, thank you for being here. I so far enjoyed the discussions very much. Now, I have to change the topic slightly. Most of the EU nations are also member of the NATO alliance, the North American Treaty Alliance, as you know. Now, the Pew organization earlier this year released a survey of NATO member states, and the question was, would you be willing to go to war if a member is being attacked? Mm. Now, of all the members, only two member states answered with a yes. All the European nations, part of the NATO, majority of the people were not willing to do that. Mm. So now that raises a couple of questions, and they flow also eventually into trade negotiations, etc., because that colors the whole discussions. Are the days of NATO counted or at the end? And furthermore, if the US, and by the way, Canada and US were the only two that said yes, or the population said yes, should that be the end of NATO as far as the US is concerned? And how is Europe or the EU going to deal with this long-term topic?
I have read this poll. Yeah, I know this poll, and it's quite shocking to see it, actually.
It is.
But be aware or be wary of polls. You know, you have to be very, very cautious when it comes to polls. The fact is, and this is something which we should keep in mind, the fact is that NATO has never been so important than now. Yeah? And that's something that President Putin has achieved, in spite of himself, I would say. That NATO has achieved a new level of importance. And when you see what NATO does now in Eastern and Central Europe now, mainly in the Baltic states, you'll see that they are extremely active. Yeah? They are extremely active. There is deployment of troops in Poland, until Estonia, there is an air policing all around. So And there is discussion, yeah, let me say that. I mean, not every EU member is, as you rightly say, is not a member of NATO, but there is a discussion whether Finland and Sweden join NATO now, all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. So I think the polls are shocking, I agree, but I think reality shows you something different. Yeah? And I would say NATO has never been as important. I don't know whether you agree, Metzi.
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, it's...
Okay, that was an easy one.
Thank you. I mean, it's just think what would... the situation looked like if NATO had not expanded, you know, 15 years, 16 years ago, we would be talking about completely different geopolitical situation. Thank God NATO expanded, and no one questions the, you know, the soundness of the security guaranteed embedded into Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, and I think that our partners in Russia know that as well very well. To the poll, I would caution about because about putting too much kind of into the swinging mood of the public opinion. And I think that this public this poll has, you know, was an expression of the fact that European nations have lived so many decades within peace and stability, not really having to think about their security. I mean, this is a, you know, this is a testament to NATO's efficiency. I mean, it's, you know, that basically the question of the physical existence of European countries was taken off the table and it's not being discussed any longer. So, you know, naturally people's attention drifted into some other issues, but it's good to know that NATO is around and NATO is adapting to the new current situation, and it's very still relevant and very still and very still alive, and I would not recommend to anybody to test its resilience because I know what the answer would be.
Good. So, I want to thank you both for coming and talking to us. Part of the theme today is to figure out how you know, events in the European Union and the progress of the European Union influences Alaska. I'd like actually to kind of flip that a bit. We've just come off the Arctic Summit. Yeah. The presidential spotlight has blasted us and now moved on. So my question would be, how might Alaska influence the European Union?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is, it's that's a tough one.
But I only answer this question if you give the mic to this young man because he tries to get your attention. Yeah, he's next. Okay. So I blackmail now. I think where Alaska can really influence the European Union is when it comes to climate change, when it comes to renewable energy research, when it comes to all the things you do so well in Fairbanks University. I've seen that over the last couple of days, and I was very impressed by the level of research. And I think the Arctic Council meeting in Anchorage was attended by a lot of European high officials, if not foreign ministers. So, and you know, countries like Italy, not exactly an Arctic country in very many ways, take a profound interest in what's going on the Arctic, and not only for geostrategic reasons, but also for environmental reasons on the future of our energy provision and stuff. And therefore, I think Alaska is an extremely interesting study ground in very many respects, not only because of the size of the state and the resources you have at disposition, but also because of your setup, you know, when it comes to the cooperation between Native Alaskans and the ones who came later, on your way of exploitation of natural resources, and I think actually the attention is quite shifting. You know, I mean, this is something which is not anymore the end of the world. It's rather one of the forefronts of the world somehow. So I think, in this respect, Alaska can be extremely useful.
Yeah. Well. You know, you wouldn't think about Poland as a kind of Arctic country, and you know, and you're right, but. But Poland has developed a huge scientific interest in studying the climate changes in the Arctic region because Arctic region is so closely tied to the Baltic Sea that is our neighborhood, and then Poland has had a scientific station located in Spitsbergen for over 50 years, and they've been very active in doing all this research, and I heard that also up in the Fairbanks we had some Polish American climatologists, and so the interest here is of course huge. Of course, I mean, when we talk about the climate change and the changes that may take place and their effects, especially for the opening up the transportation routes and kind of granting access to new reserves of the resources, that brings about a lot of questions in terms of opportunities and some hazards, and this is something that we would like to discuss together also with the Alaskan scientists and Alaskan government and people. Now, Alaska is blessed with oil and gas, and then Poland is very much dependent on one source of the energy from the east, and we've been kind of advocating for a change in the U.S. policy regarding the exports of oil, and in a sense that it would send a very strong political signal that energy resources should not be used to obtain some political goals and ends, and this is something that might be also of interest in the Polish-Alaskan conversation.
You made it.
Hello, my name is Gerhard Sells. I'm a local university student. I suppose I have a multi-pronged question for you guys, and the first one being, it's a refugee question again, I suppose, how is the EU, going to take this situation, and will this situation actually drive a wedge between the countries, even more that have cropped up since, I suppose, the Greek bailouts and so forth and the financial crisis? Is this going to drive a wedge between that country cooperation between EU nation states, or is it actually going to allow for more cooperation? Because from what we've so far seen is that there's a lot of shortcomings with the response. There's actually a lot of change, or between the countries, there's a lot of different responses to this crisis, I suppose I could call it. Also the shortcomings of the Dublin Accords and what the EU has already established to deal with refugees, for example. And this goes into the second part of my question, I suppose, because how is the EU as a united unit, going to deal with this response, especially considering the fact that there's, especially since each country is viewing this differently, but they also had a military incursion along the northern African coast to also prevent more refugees coming in. Mm. It seems to be bouncing back and forth, and what are they driving for? What is the EU driving for in this crisis?
This guy is a landsman, so you should start.
Okay, all right. I would agree with my German colleague that if we allow this situation with the immigrants and refugees to continue on its own as it is, we would put into jeopardy some very key and fundamental achievement of the European construction, which is, for instance, open borders, free movement of people, and goods, and so this is really becoming a central existential question. So I don't really see kind of allowing this thing to develop on its own as a viable option. I mean, I think that there is a shared understanding in Europe that Europe needs to come up with unified and workable solution as a one. It's not that only a few countries are affected by this. This is the whole community which is which is affected. And I don't want to talk about this only in a kind of in terms of concerns or challenges, but also in terms of some opportunities. And definitely in Poland, we understand that some sort of the common European action is needed, because we should not only show solidarity to those who are affected by the wars, but also we should think creatively how to preserve the so far achievements and benefits of the of the European Union. And single market is, of course, in a core of it. So I am this is not first crisis for the European Union. It's probably not the last one. If you look at the EU history, the integration impulses very often came in the situation of very stressful crisis. So that might be one of those opportunities that we will emerge from this strengthened and better prepared to deal with such contingencies. Contingencies in the future. That would be my take on it.
I think that the all the regulations for asylum seekers in Europe, like you mentioned the Dublin Agreement, were not conceived for crises like this. I mean, nobody would have thought that this would happen one day. So I think they are not applicable in the way they were in the spirit in which they were conceived right now. But one thing is, I totally agree with what Mathieu says. But I think one thing is really at stake here, and that's what one of the biggest European achievements is, the open border system, mm-hmm. that you cross your border from one country to the other. I remember I brought an American friend to Aachen, which is in the very far out west Germany, and we walked through a wood, and I said, now we are in Holland, and we two steps further, we were in Belgium, and then we were in Germany again. And nobody can understand that, that you just cross the border so easily. And that's something which I think we all consider as a big achievement. And if that is put into question, that's very bad, I think. This Schengen Accord, if that is not really going to work out anymore, then I think Europe is in a certain way is endangered. That doesn't mean that sometimes we cannot control borders, which mm-hmm. is done. The G8 summit was when border controls were reintroduced, and even now the Italians now control the borders a bit more carefully. But at the end of the day, we need to keep this open border system, which is one of the backbones of the European spirit. Wedges between the countries, yes. I think there are deep disagreements between partners in the EU. But that we know, this we are used to. There are deep disagreements on every matter in the EU. Yeah? That's why it's so complicated. Not only refugees. Now, refugees is very urgent because we are exposed to them so clearly. But the fact that people don't agree on questions is a lifeline of the European Union. So I think perhaps being a bit more cautious, but Mathieu is right in saying that the EU has shown strength in these crises all the time. So there is hope that they will come to an agreement that might be different and also not extremely clear, but that people say, okay, we agree this is a major challenge and everybody has to share the part of the burden here. Yeah? And that includes what you very rightly say, a protection
of the border,
in the Mediterranean. And that's not in, and let me get that very straight, it's not to send back all these boats, it's fighting human trafficking, and that's the worst part of it. Now, human trafficking is the worst part of this crisis, and we have to try to get everything possible to get these human traffickers and to punish them.
And if I may just one sentence on this, because it's been the kind of talking. It's been kind of seen as a European problem. I mean, this refugees crisis. Now, if you think about the origins, I mean, why those people are fleeing their countries. What caused them to seek a new life under very stressful and desperate situation? I mean, this is the whole turmoil in the Middle East and Northern Africa. I mean, it's not only Europeans' problem, and this is very much of global problem, and then it should be also tackled by wider international community. It cannot be delegated only, you know, to Europe just to deal with this.
Let me be a bit German here. You know, he's an elegant Polish gentleman. What about the U.S. in this context? Yeah? Yeah. I see 10,000 refugees the government has announced. 10,000, it's nothing. I'm sorry. And Canada, 260 families. It's nothing. These are classical immigration countries. I don't think that, you know, I mean, everybody has to participate, but 10,000 is not really a very convincing solution. I mean, we expect that Poland takes 10,000 and or something like that, you know, and the U.S. Is rather weak on this. You know, and you have much more experience than many other countries in the world when it comes to integrate these kind of refugees. I was in Detroit and I've seen the Arab community, 70,000 Arabs in Dearborn near Detroit. They are flourishing and, you know, the people, the mayor of Detroit longs for them. They want to have them. I mean, speaking of being complicated, the U.S. immigration system is super complicated. Yeah, I mean, this, it's not. I mean, you could, I think, even do more, and Canada too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hi, thank you for listening to me. I would like to know, how is the EU dealing with Hungary, which really right now is not in line and closes its borders? They do not pay attention to Schengen. And I'm just wondering, how is the EU, Brussel, trying to deal with it? Thank you.
It's a difficult question. I would say that, first of all, let me say that Hungary is really exposed to this crisis. We should not forget there are hundreds of thousands of refugees going through Hungary, and this is a small place, and they are overflooded by the refugees. It's not, I mean, there are other countries like, let's say, Portugal or Ireland that are not exposed to this crisis, and Hungary, but let me finish. Hungary is certainly at the forefront of this whole crisis. Now, we are not, and I'm talking for Germany, we are not convinced by the way Hungary is dealing with this crisis. No, we feel that neither the way they deal with the refugees, nor the way they have, nor the sort of the discourse they have on the refugees in the capital, in Budapest, is convincing us. I think we have a different point of view. And we have to try to find an agreement on that. But one thing is clear, the EU has also to help Hungary to a certain extent. I mean, to get there and in order to channel these refugees in the right way. Hungary, I see your point. I understand also the problem that we have, but we should not forget it's one of the most vulnerable points, right, in Europe right now. Yeah.
And I would only add that Hungary has been a part of the conversation. I mean, it's not that Hungary is not participating. I mean, it's only today there was a meeting in Prague between foreign ministers of Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia, and German foreign minister, and the Luxembourgian foreign minister, you know, about what to do with this, with these issues. I mean, there might be some problems, some outstanding questions, and then issues to ponder. But all those countries are sitting at the table, you know, thinking and talking how to tackle the problem. Yeah. Yeah. Here.
Last question.
Oh, we take a few questions. Yeah, maybe
it's you. You have to decide.
Okay.
Thank you. This is a question from my 18-year-old who couldn't be here today. He's on a tennis trip coming up here, but he's very interested in this. He actually arranged entirely on his own to have a German exchange student come to our house for the year, and he is intent on finishing some of his education in Germany with your tuition program. And I think he is coming at it, this is coming at it from his personal viewpoint, is he sees the refugee crisis as a world problem, And there are so many people here that are so impressed by what Germany's doing. But how does the EU get more involved? The Saudis, obviously, the US, you know, what's the framework for getting more people involved? And he's very worried about the open borders. And is that an EU law? Is that possibly going to be changed? I think you touched on that already. And what was the other part? Oh, with all the young population of refugees, do you see that changing Germany's open borders now with US students coming into college?
We love US students coming to Germany, because I'll reveal a secret here. Higher education in German universities are free. There is no tuition for foreigners as well as for Germans. So, welcome to Germany. to answer the questions, and let me add, I mean, we have talked about a lot already, but let me add two aspects. One is, you've seen that, you know, Germany is very generous with the refugees, and it's all over the news, and we are very happy about it because we get praise. But you should not forget, there is also, it's a big problem in Germany. It's not that people are not unhappy. You know, the people are, they are part of Germany where people feel really overwhelmed. They feel afraid. And even though it might not be the truth, or might not be as real as they think it is, but, you know, when you have a village of about 2,000 inhabitants in northern Bavaria, and 700 refugees come in this village from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, people feel threatened in their way of life somehow. And you have to take that into consideration. So that's a big thing. And, you know, with all our generosity, we should not forget we have to take the population along. We have to convince the population that these refugees we can benefit from them somehow. So what we have is that in Germany, that people are very empathetic, feel a lot of empathy when it comes to Syria, because we have seen over the last 4 years, the terrible sort of situation in Syria and the dreadful developments, and so people feel that these people come from war-ridden countries, and others are less welcome. Yeah? Let's face it. Yeah? People are not as empathetic with other nationalities. But the second point I would add is Germany, like Poland and all the other European countries, have one big problem: they are aging society. The U.S. is doing much better than Europe when it comes to birth rates and, you know, rejuvenating the population. We are particularly bad in Germany. We are really aging. So we need migration. We need it. And that's a policy of the government. So we should also see these refugee influx as a chance also for it. It's perhaps, you know, we get very good citizens out of them. And this is something where, you know, I think the government should also put people's mind on. You know, we need these guys. They are, you know, when you come from a war-ridden country, that's referring to your country, but I mean, these people are traumatized. But when they go in a country that gives them shelter and say, this is a peaceful environment, if you want to work and if you want to set up a new existence, feel free to do so. They are excellent citizens. They love Germany much more than many Germans do, because they have this... They got the chance of starting afresh. And that's something we should also, I mean, don't be too defensive on the issue. We have also to think in a positive mind. And therefore, I feel that if it's not exploding, and there is the danger that it explodes number-wise with the refugees, but if it's at a certain pace, then I think we might be in a position to digest this migrant flows. And it might, at the end of the day, even be beneficial to us. 800,000, I think, is doable, but 1.6 million is not so much.
Well, I would like to thank both. Switches. So, thanks very much to DCMs Ackerman and Pisarski. So, appreciate that very much. I know there are folks who would very much like to carry on the conversation. We only have the room for a certain amount of time, okay. However, we do have
this evening, 6 o'clock at the Atwood Mansion for World Affairs Council members, our reception. And if you'd like to carry on that conversation, you have an opportunity to do that then. So we certainly look forward to seeing you later this evening. At the beginning of our program, we made certain acknowledgments of various dignitaries who have joined us. There are a couple, some important members of the World Affairs Council family who are also require acknowledgement. Debbie and Phyllis, who are the folks from the Hilton who have been with us for so many years. It is our understanding that this is Debbie's last day. And so we would certainly like to thank her and Phyllis for all that they have done for us over the years. So I have here a couple of gifts in honor of our speakers, mementos of Alaska. I strongly suspect that we shall be seeing both of you again at some point in the future. We seem to have made an impression, which we're very pleased. Would like to remind those of you who are not yet members of the World Affairs Council, there are cards on the table, and two benefits at this time is, one, you can join us at the Atwood Mansion this evening at 6 o'clock, and two, the Atwood Foundation is matching new memberships or increased memberships, so we would certainly encourage you all to come and join us. We also hope to see you at our events next week. We have events on both Wednesday and Friday here at the Hilton. Both events start at noon. Doors open at 11:30. More information on these events and our upcoming lineup is on the door, on the small cards that you see on the table, or alaskaworldaffairs.org, or our Facebook page. If you would like to help us by recycling your name tags for future events, that would always be very, very helpful and environmentally responsible. And so we thank you very much and look forward to seeing you this evening. So thank you.